Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Alternative Media. I am your host, Patrick Slattery. And with me this week, we have our very special guest from last week, Andrew Joyce, Professor Andrew Joyce, a daring young scholar who's willing to investigate issues that no one else has the guts to. He's a very capable scholar, and we had a discussion last week that had a very good response, and people wanted me to bring him back for part two. I'm going to do better than that. He will be the guest for the next 2 hours, part two and part three of the interview that we had actually conducted last week. And so without further ado, I'm going to start playing that interview. He was responding to a question about the Jewish relationship with the government, and he's just going to start talking about Jews and gun control. Let's have a listen.
This insatiable craving for strengthened government powers, increased police protection, and guarding of synagogues and protection of Jews. And gun control is another aspect of that. It's very, very uncomfortable for Jewish organizations and many Jewish groups for the population of the United States to have access to arms. It's simply unconscionable to these groups, given their agenda and their wish to advance their power. They have a suspicion of rural people. In particular, Kevin MacDonald has written sort of extensively about the kind of scathing attitude that Jewish journalists and writers, authors, how they've portrayed rural dwelling Christians, live conservative lifestyles, who aren't on board for gay marriage and all of these social innovations. They're seen as monsters. They're portrayed as inbred, ignorant, of a really, really low intelligence. And this has a long tradition within Judaism and Jewish culture as well. When I think back to the riots in Kishinev, just at the late 19th and early 20th century, all of the Jewish poetry and sort of recollections and writing that emerged in the background of really what was a series of economic riots, but in the portrayals, these Russian peasants and country people were portrayed as violent brutes, animals, beasts of the field, incredibly derogatory, fearful terms. There is a real fear there. We shouldn't get into the habit of believing kind of the Jews' own hype, or believing even some of the hype that people in our movement produced, that this group of people is impervious and indestructible and believes itself to be all powerful. I believe that the Jews want to advance their interests as most ethnic groups should, but I believe that there is a fearfulness within Jewish culture. It is a real suspicion of the non-Jew, and in particular of the European. One of the book reviews that I wrote a few years ago now was a book by Anthony Julius called Trials of the Diaspora. It was a history of anti-Semitism in Britain, in England in particular, actually, I should say. And the book starts off in a autobiographical sense with Anthony Julius describing his childhood and recollecting his grandmother telling him these tales.
And this is a Jewish author.
Yes, Anthony Julius. And he's describing his grandmother warning him about the goyim. She describes them as she tells the young Anthony Julius, they aren't like us. Be wary, be cautious. And then he also describes an incident on a railway carriage where he was traveling. He was about 9 or 10 with his father. He was I think a traveling salesman, and this guy, I think his father had a friend with him called Arthur, I think that was his name. And Arthur happened to lean over and say to Julius's father, "You know, I had a Jewish family over for tea just the other day, and they brought their daughter, and she was just so delightful and had the most wonderful manners." And apparently, Julius says that his father sat with a seething expression on his face, seething. And he later took the young Julius aside and said to him, "Why is he telling me that? Am I supposed to be impressed that he thinks that a young Jewish girl has good manners?" And the way that this comment from Arthur had been interpreted was that it was patronizing, was that it was insinuating that not all Jews have good manners, and generally that this was an anti-Semitic comment. Now, it's clear to me reading it, and I think it's clear to just about anyone who hears the story, that it was just a polite Englishman making small talk and trying to find some mode of connection between himself and his Jewish business associate, you know, mm-hmm. mentioning that he had a Jewish family, or perhaps wanting to talk a little about Judaism or Jewish culture, who knows? But it really takes a very suspicious, a very paranoid mindset to perceive that effort at small talk as gravely insulting or as anti-Semitic. And that's really what we're dealing with here. It's very broad. It's very expansive across the Jewish community. I've experienced it myself. You and I, Patrick, were talking just a couple of days ago about these stories where Jews love to play this game of who's a Jew. Mm-hmm. Whether it's famous people, they, as we've already discussed, they particularly like it when someone like Spinoza or someone notable, he's Jewish. But if we were to attempt to get in on that game as non-Jews and say, "Oh yeah, isn't such and such also a Jew?" There will be dead silence. You know, you can hear a pin drop, and you will be looked at, and you will be suspected. And people will question your motives as to why you're so interested in whether someone is Jewish or not. That's with all the best motives and intentions in the world. Mm-hmm. Just because of it's an outgrowth of this paranoid mindset.
Right. There's a man named Ben Stein who's a lawyer. Hollywood lawyer. He's had a foot in politics and a foot in the media for decades. He actually his father had been one of President Nixon's economic advisors, and he had a job actually as a speechwriter for, I think, both Nixon and his vice president Agnew. But in the 1990s, he had a game show called Win Ben Stein's Money, which was kind of a funny game show. He was always a contestant, and you were trying to see if you were smarter than Ben Stein. He was very arrogant, but he had a funny sidekick who's now Jimmy Kimmel, who's now one of the late night talk show hosts. At any rate, one of the contestants on the show once did a Woody Allen impression. Now, the contestant wasn't Jewish, and Ben Stein, who always has kind of a serious look on his face, but he had more serious than usual look, and he said, "Number one rule of Hollywood: Jews impersonate non-Jews, not the other way around." He's just kind of laying down the law. And, you know, that's similar to what we were just talking about. Jews can talk about Jewish power. I mean, Ben Stein himself had written an often quoted article where he's saying, the title of the article was something like, "Do Jews run Hollywood? You betcha, and what of it?" And he lists names of all the studio heads and everybody and says, "Of course we run Hollywood. What's wrong with that?" Now, if somebody else, Rick Sanchez from CNN, for instance, simply sarcastically implies that the people who run CNN and the people who run a lot of the other news companies are Jewish, he gets fired the next day. That's... Now, regarding the Jewish population of the UK, the current Jewish population, I know it's not more than a few tenths of a percent, But what's their origin? How long have they? How many are people like Disraeli who presumably have been in the UK for many generations, and how many are more recent, say post World War II or 20th century emigres from the continent or from the former Soviet Union?
Well, the history of Jews in Britain is very, very old, and at times it's been interrupted and broken also. As far as I can tell, the first Jews to arrive in Britain arrived with the Normans around 1066. So, you know, before that they'd been in Normandy and northern France as traders. They were, you know, predominantly, I suppose you would describe them as from the Ashkenaz group. And they arrived and really set themselves up from the beginning as moneylenders. And as I've explained earlier, they cozied up to the elite, the monarchy, very, very quickly, provided him with cash loans, funded wars, lent money at interest to the nobles and the barons, and also, interestingly enough, to the Christian churches. You know, many of the cathedrals, the ancient cathedrals currently standing in England, were funded with Jewish money, and as a result, you know, there were many, many Christian churches which from day one were indebted to Jews, because the interest rates on these loans were really astronomical, you know, phenomenally large. And it was by money lending and living off of interest that this community basically was able to survive at all, because it was not professionally diverse. Some Jewish academics have tried to argue that there was a lot more diversity in terms of the occupation pursued by this early Jewish population. But no evidence whatsoever has been produced for it. They just claim it. I mean, we were talking earlier about Jewish networking. Well, in the course of an article I wrote on, it was actually a book review of that book by Anthony Julius, Trials of the Diaspora, there's a whole section in it where he talks about how people have this misconception of English Jews as being moneylenders and what have you. And he cites a book, I think it was by Barron, Economic History of the Jews. Mm. And in this book, Barron had basically just come up with this bald statement of, you know, the professional, the occupational profile of this early Jewish community was very, very diverse. And, you know, they were singers and they were craftsmen and all the rest. But he doesn't provide a single footnote or source. He just references another book written by a Jewish author. So I went and I got that book, and I read this book, and again it referenced another Jewish author. So I went and got that book, and it really, when I got down to the bottom, there was no documentary basis for saying that this early Jewish population was occupationally diverse. It was simply Jewish academics citing each other, mm-hmm. and over time a credibility to the lazy academic who doesn't want to research any deeper, the credibility is established just because Simon Cohen published his book through Oxford University Press. It's an elite publisher, therefore all the content must be okay. But unbeknownst to the common man, Oxford University Press had the book reviewed prior to publication by Solomon Greenberg, who, you know, knew that it probably wasn't intellectually viable, but passed it for publication anyway, because it suits Jewish interests to expand this narrative and push this idea that the early Jewish population of Britain, or any Jewish population, is occupationally diverse, and certainly wasn't overwhelmingly represented among moneylenders. Mm-hmm. So, but this was the nature of that first Jewish population in England, until their expulsion in 1290 under Edward I. And the background to that expulsion has its root in the fact that if the elite is not strong, if the people get too much power, normally Jewish influence suffers. And the reason why this particular expulsion happened was that the barons and the nobles who had become increasingly frustrated with their indebtedness to these Jewish moneylenders, they basically, what would happen was that if they needed some short-term cash for whatever it might be a inter-regional feud or something of that nature, they would go and borrow money from the Jews because it was easy and that's the only real instant cash that they could get. Or in some cases, the king might make them go to his Jews because the king would take a little bit of a tax off of the loans as well. And technically and legally, the Jews were classed as his property. But sometimes under compulsion, these barons would be forced to take loans from the Jews. The interest rates would be so high and the terms would be so restrictive that eventually the barons or the nobles would default on the loan. And if they defaulted on the loan, the Jews had the right to seize property. And most commonly, the property they would seize would be land. But Jews were prohibited from owning land, so the land would then pass over the heads of the Jews back to the king, and the king would then give a slice of the pie in financial terms to the Jews. So it was a really symbiotic relationship between the king and the Jews. But all the while, the lower classes, going right up to the nobles, grew increasingly frustrated. And what it did was these previously fractured barons and nobles who really didn't like each other that much started to band together. And once they had banded together and formed the kind of cohesive political will that actually resulted in Magna Carta, once they formed this, it was a formidable challenge to the power and authority of the king. And when that happened, once that balance just tipped just a little bit too much away from the king, the power of the Jews was also damaged significantly. And whenever a period of negotiation came up between Edward I, who I believe was no great fan of the Jews anyway, but one of the key demands of the barons was that this Jewish community should be expelled wholesale from England. Mm-hmm. Every last one of them. Edward I agreed. He consented. And Jews were expelled en masse from England. The country was, to use that term, it's better than any other, Jew-free for some ensuing centuries, all through the period of Shakespeare. There was hardly a Jew in the land, although it's said that Queen Elizabeth I's physician was Jewish. But certainly that there was no Jewish community in England right up until the time of Oliver Cromwell. Now, Oliver Cromwell...
And that would be the late 1600s.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm. Oliver Cromwell was, a religious fundamentalist in many respects. But he wasn't particularly preoccupied with Jews or Jewish affairs or even Jewish history. But he was approached by letter by a Dutch Jew named Menasseh ben Israel at some point. And basically, ben Israel was representing the business interests of the Dutch Jewish community in Holland and the Netherlands. And he basically floated to Cromwell a proposal. And you can still look up this proposal. You can Google it online, and I urge all listeners to go and take a look at it, because it's actually a masterwork in Jewish propaganda. Firstly, it shows an amazing awareness of the proclivities of the subject. For example, realizing that Oliver Cromwell was more than likely to be a religious fundamentalist, someone who believed that perhaps the return of Christ was imminent, Ben Israel started playing this whole card of, well, you know, in the book of Revelation, it says that Jews need to be scattered to all the ends of the earth before Christ comes back. And, you know, as long as this ban remains in place on Jews settling as a community in Britain, Jews can't reach the ends of the earth. And therefore, you, Oliver Cromwell, and the government there in England are preventing the return of Christ. So, you know, as far as arguments go, you know, basically saying to someone, look, if you don't let us in, you're not fulfilling, you know, the will of your God.
It's certainly kind of, echoes, there's echoes of the Jewish manipulation of Christian Zionists in America.
Absolutely. This is a long history, and it really goes back to this first letter. There is a direct and organic line between Christian Zionism going right back to this letter to Cromwell. So on the one hand, there was that. But just in case Cromwell was a little bit more materialistic or a little bit more earthly than he was otherwise letting on, the second part of the letter was essentially a business proposal. Ben Israel basically says to Cromwell, look, if you let us in, we are experts in business, trade and commerce. We have commercial links to ports throughout the world, and England will become richer if it permits a Jewish community to develop in London and in the other major cities and towns of England. It was, as I say, a masterful piece of propaganda. It was an excellent case study in persuasive writing, and Cromwell bought it, and Jews were readmitted. Really, I should say unofficially, because the expulsion was never actually rescinded. That expulsion in 1290 is technically still, you know, technically speaking, still law. And as far as I can tell from the law books, every Jew currently living in England is living there illegally, in one of those strange quirks of history. Uh-huh. But, you know, without it being an explicit act of Parliament, Cromwell essentially readmitted the Jews to England. Now, the Jews who settled in England following readmission were predominantly Sephardic. So they were Portuguese, Spanish descended, you know, going back a few centuries. They tended to have, you know, the more swarthy sort of Spanish appearance, a bit more identifiably Middle Eastern. They also tended to dress a little more exotically than the Ashkenaz, and that nature that is really was an example of someone who could trace his ancestry back to the readmission into that Sephardic community. But in the late 18th century and early 19th century, there was a drift of sort of German origin, and some from St. Petersburg also, Ashkenaz Jews who started to come in. And gradually they started to grow until there was kind of a 50-50 split in the Jewish population of England. But then, as the whole Western world really experienced in, you know, really beginning in the 1860s, but really reaching a peak in the 1880s, there was a vast explosion of the Ostjuden, the Eastern Jews from the Tsarist Empire in Russia and the Polish lands as well. And that really transformed not only the Jewish populations of that was in England at that time, but obviously and quite fatefully, it transformed the fortunes of whole nations. You know, and certainly by 1910, the West was not the same entity that it once was. Mm-hmm.
And you've also looked into this current round of mass immigration. What's the Jewish role in the current round of mass immigration into both Britain and Europe as a whole?
I think the current round of mass immigration is more complex than any in history. the mass Jewish immigration of 1880 to 1910 is I think a lot more easily explained. We can see where Jews were publicly and explicitly active on behalf of their fellow Jews in terms of writing sympathetic or propagandistic atrocity stories in the major newspapers. Certainly the London Times had a large number of Jewish journalists. The Jewish World, New York Times, you know, there were many Jewish correspondents who greatly exaggerated the situation in the Tsarist Empire at that time, with a clear view to pulling on the heartstrings of the populations of the United States and a huge number of Western European countries in order to facilitate an atmosphere which would welcome in, or if not welcome, then just certainly kind of turn a blind eye to the mass influx of Jews from the East. Today, we're witnessing something a lot more complex. Yes, Jews are definitely manipulating media narratives. That much is obvious. When I you know read the articles of Jonathan Friedland, the Jewish editor of the Guardian, you know they're just so sanguine and so emotional and so florid in the style of writing. You know, it almost makes me sick. But you know the onus is constantly being placed on us as Europeans and people of European descent to welcome in these third worlders as a moral obligation. You know, if we refuse to take these people in, we are no better than the German government of 1933 to 1945, as they keep telling us. You know, we are hate-filled Nazis and bigots and whatever other slur they might wish to direct towards us. But I wish it was as simple as saying that this is just a matter of Jewish manipulation of the media narrative. Unfortunately, the ball that many Jewish intellectuals got rolling in earnest in the 1950s and 60s now has a momentum of its own.
Mm-hmm.
We have this social justice warrior phenomena, which affects what appears to be in the main the millennial age group, and you know there's a fanaticism there which now operates, unfortunately, independently of large scale Jewish incitement. You know, it's got a mindset of its own. It's a monster. It's the Frankenstein creation of Jewish intellectualism. And it's operating on behalf of Jewish interests implicitly
and unconsciously in many cases.
Oh, absolutely, unconsciously. These people, these social justice warrior types, simply cannot see where their strings are being pulled. They just simply believe that every action that they undertake, every nationalist demonstration that they attempt to disrupt, every person that they attempt to get fired, they believe that this takes them a step closer to being some kind of divine human being of supreme moral credentials.
And the irony, in the United States, at least, the irony is that many of them see themselves as being pro-Palestinian and anti-Zionist, yet are promoters of really the Jewish supremacist agenda.
Of course, they can't make the links. They don't see the ideological instruction because they believe that their Jewish professors or these sparkling Jewish intellects that pop up now and then are what they claim to be, and that is that they are kind of world citizens. That's you know, it's this idea that we're all in this together. We're all just human beings. And let's just all love each other because that's the way to have sunshine and rainbows and a glorious future. I mean, it's pure utopianism, bordering on madness. And one of the most disconcerting aspects of all of this to me as well, and I wrote about this recently on the Occidental Observer, is that the mainstream Christian churches are fully on board as well, and this is yet another facet of the current problem that we face. You know, we've got Jewish intellectual influence, We've got the social justice warrior phenomena operating almost independently now. And we have, you know, this interpretation of modern Christianity, which is ultra-universalist, sees no place for the nation state or the race or the ethnicity. And, you know, rather than it being morally wrong to object to, you know, third worlders coming in huge numbers, enough to completely transform our societies, we have the church is saying that to object to this influx is sinful, that it is contrary to the wishes of God. And for the religiously inclined and the religiously minded, this is tantamount to an injunction to commit racial suicide. There's no other way to put it. And it is, to my mind and in my opinion, one of the most insidious and poisonous developments of recent times. You know, losing the churches, we lose a potentially great ally. And of course, a lot of this goes back to the 1960s, where, you know, Jewish converts in particular managed to get into high positions in the Catholic Church, completely revise the Catholic Church's position on the Jewish question.
So I want some clarification. So Jewish converts, and are you referring to Vatican II? Were they instrumental in Vatican II? And these are Jewish converts. And how recent of converts were they? Were they people who converted in their own lifetime, or people whose parents converted?
I think they converted in their own lifetime. Kevin McDonald has written a little bit more extensively on the subject than I have, but I'm pretty sure they converted in their own lifetime. And I, you know, one of the first things that these people did, they were very influential with, I know also with Pope John Paul II. And it was these converts that were instrumental in, for example, the Catholic Church used to have a prayer for the blindness of the Jews. So I think it was read out every Good Friday. So, you know, it was a prayer, you know, we pray for, you know, the blindness of the Jews to who the Messiah really is to be lifted. And we pray for, you know, this people that, you know, played a part in the crucifixion of Christ, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we're not looking at something that condemned Jewish people here. But what it did do, obviously, was that, you know, with the millions or probably over a billion Catholics worldwide, is it reminded them that the Jews were a separate people, that they were, that they once played a less than wonderful role in Christian history. And for Jews, you can imagine that this was a thorn in the side for many, many years, centuries. So it should come as no surprise that eventually they find a way to get in and breach the walls. You know, conversion doesn't really demand that much of a Jew, especially if it's insincere. Actually, during the 19th century, there used to be a thing called a wet Jew, and this was a baptized Jew. And there were, you know, there was a great missionary fervor both in the United States and in the United Kingdom, and I think also in Prussia in the 1840s and 1850s. And lots of missionaries went out with this idea that the end of the world was coming, and they were going to usher it in by converting every single Jew to Christianity. So lots of money was generated among non-Jews at the time to fund these missionary efforts. So, you know, there were street conversions and all the rest. But one of the things that they did was they would give the newly converted Jew a little bit of money. Now, what developed then was a professional wet Jew. This was a Jew who would get a little bit of water sprinkled on his head every Sunday. He would just travel around the country visiting different churches, say he wanted to be converted. He would get a little bit of splash of holy water, take his coin, and move on to the next town. And it was a way of making a living. So I believe that the Jews genuinely don't like Christianity, but I believe it's more for social and ethnic reasons than any kind of religious content. Most Jews are atheistic. I think we can agree on that argument. And I think that the idea of having holy water sprinkled on them in order to achieve any kind of end, be it political, social, or economic, is not a great price for them to pay. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, for the religiously sincere among non-Jews, they don't see that, and they believe that the act of baptism will have a much more profound effect on the Jew being baptized, and the person who walks away from that baptism is no longer a Jew but a Christian. But we know, because of the long history of what so-called converted Jews or Jewish converts have achieved, going right back to the conversos of pre-Inquisition Spain, that actually, in many cases, converted Jews can be among the most dangerous in terms of threatening our interests as an ethnic group.
Mm-hmm. Well, converted Jews often continue with the ethnic networking. It doesn't change the ethnicity.
Precisely.
Do you have any... I'm going to something completely different now, but are you familiar with the Young Turks?
I am. I've watched a couple of their shows.
Oh, I didn't mean those Young Turks. That would be another subject. I meant the Young Turks of from, I guess, mainly Salonika, who took over the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah. I'm broadly familiar. I wouldn't be well versed in the specifics, but yes, I've got a rough idea of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know if neither of us have a great deal of expertise, if it's a good topic for discussion, but you know, they were. I'm just making a note here of where we are, because I think I'll cut this out. But the young Turks, many of them were Jewish. How many? It's a little hard to say, but they were largely from this city, which is now in Greece, Salonika or Thessalonica. And if you go back 100 years ago, about 40% of the population was Jewish there. It was a Jewish concentration, and the so there's this issue of how Jewish were the Young Turks? How responsible were the Jews for the Armenian genocide? But I don't have specialized knowledge in it. I just know there's a certain plausibility to it because the region that these people were from, some are kind of officially listed as being Jewish. It's not a secret, but others, you know, like I guess. Kemal Ataturk. Or Mustafa Kemal, I guess, was his name. Whether or not he was of Jewish ancestry, but we don't have to go there. Is there anywhere else you'd like to? Any other topic you'd like to discuss?
We could maybe talk about the economic stuff. I mean, it's up to you whether you feel like you have enough for the show already.
I got a lot for the show, but everything doesn't. I mean, I'm not necessarily going to do it all tonight. I'll do much of it tonight, but I might save some for next week. What areas of the economy are you familiar with, or what economic stuff are you?
I was probably going to touch on the white collar crime issue. That might be worth talking about.
Okay.
We've covered Spinoza and gun control and
immigration,
free speech stuff. We've covered a lot. We've actually covered a lot of ground. More than I thought we would in the time frame. But yeah, it's kind of flown by.
So with the economics, I mean, I was thinking of a way to segue into it. I saw a show like CNN is doing this series on the 80s, and last night, well, I'll go into it this way. So last night I was watching an episode from this new CNN series on the 1980s, and this one particular episode was called Greed, and they went over a lot of things. They went over some of the famous ministers, television ministers who bilked their flocks, but they also went over, and of course they had to mention Donald Trump because he was a kind of a cultural icon starting in the 1980s. But a lot of the show was focused on these Wall Street financiers, the corporate raiders, and not all of them were Jewish, but a surprising amount of them. Well, surprising if you relate it just to the 2% Jewish share of the population, a surprising number were Jewish. People like Michael Milken, who was his Wikipedia page lists him as a financier and a philanthropist, but of course he had bilked massive numbers of people with junk bonds and had to spend time in prison for it. So there's this Jewish domination of the economy, and some of it is through ethnic networking, where they are able to set up successful companies that operate legally. But then there's this other dimension of it, of insider trading and all sorts of economic malfeasance. You've done a good deal of research into the Jewish role in the economy. What are some of the interesting aspects of your research that you'd like to relate to us?
Well, I think if there's one kind of overarching theme of my work in terms of Jews and the economy, even going right back deep into history, it's really boils down to wealth transfer, and whether that's through tax farming in the Middle Ages, or whether that's through using ethnic networking to gain government contracts in the 18th or 19th century, or fraudulent enterprises like the Indian silver scandal, the Marconi scandal during the period of the British Empire, right the way up to, as you described, these characters that populate Wall Street. What we see is large-scale financial fraud, which concentrates a large amount of money, ill-gotten gains, into the hands of a small number of, relatively small number, of these Jewish millionaires and billionaires, criminals. But the money doesn't stop there. That's the crucial point that I want to emphasize. It's not just that these men steal all of this money and that's where it ends. You mentioned that Milken was described as a philanthropist. Mm-hmm. And this is a word that you will hear used about many, many, many of these Jewish white-collar criminals. They are philanthropists. Now, to the unthinking person who just hears that and is on a news report or whatever, always a philanthropist, they might think, oh, well, he can't be all that bad. He can't be all that bad, but the thing that's really understated to an astonishing degree is that this philanthropy is geared almost exclusively towards Jewish causes, Jewish charities, and Jewish interests, whether it's shipping the money off to Israel, whether it's sending it to the ADL, or whether it's to Jewish care or funding some Jewish old people's home or schools or whatever it might be. But it's the transfer of criminally attained wealth into the Jewish community as a whole and benefiting the Jewish community as a whole. And I think that there is a sphere of responsibility there which certainly deserves to be discussed more, but which currently it's just not even on the table. We're allowed to talk about the collective responsibility of the white male when we talk about feminism and things. All men are implicitly, part of a rape culture or whatever it might be. All white males today or white people are somehow collectively responsible for slavery or for the Holocaust or whatever, any cause that they might want to throw up. But the idea of collective responsibility dries up very, very, very quickly when one moves on to subjects of Jewish criminality or Jews doing things wrong. For example, to imply that the Jews shared a collective responsibility in Russia for the rise of communism and lots of the atrocities that were carried out under communist governments. That's just anathema. You just can't go there. And you know, there are myriad examples that we could go into. But the overarching theme of my work is this idea of wealth transfer. And the most commonly used argument against this idea that Jews are communally or collectively responsible for this pattern of wealth transfer is that it's a canard. It's a canard. And if I can refer back to an earlier example where I said that that one historian basically popped up and said that the economic profile of the earliest English Jewish community was occupationally diverse. He was just cited by another historian, and he was cited by another historian, and all of a sudden we have this artificially created credibility. Well, this idea of the canard is basically the same process. Simply by saying it's a canard, they believe that they make it so. But it's clear that it's not a canard. It's actually not even a stereotype. It's a fact. One of the features of my work is that I try not to make broad, sweeping statements. I try and avoid it where I can. And where I do say something like, you know, Jews are overrepresented in financial crime, I look for statistics. You know, I look for sources. And I'm very, very selective in the sources that I use. So you know, this Jewish financial malpractice is something that troubles me greatly, and it troubles me even greater that it's so under-acknowledged. So over the past few months, I've been doing research, and I plucked out some Jewish sources. Everything was published by the likes of Yale University Press, Harvard University Press, credible sources that are not easily refuted. And just by chance, I discovered this one article published in 1971 by a Jewish author called Criminality Among Jews, an Overview. The journal was published by Yale University Press. And then I found a book by a guy called Stanton Wheeler, again published by Yale University Press in 1988. And he'd conducted this huge survey, which took into account the proportion of Jews in white-collar professions, and he found that Jews were overrepresented in white-collar crime, while Protestants and Catholics were underrepresented. But two sources isn't enough for me, so I looked again, and I found a 1991 book by David Weisberg, again published by Yale University Press, mm-hmm. Called Crimes of the Middle Classes. And he found that Jews were responsible. This is a Yale University source.
And
a Jewish author saying that Jews were responsible for a third of the highest category of seriousness of financial crimes. So we're talking about, real securities fraud, the real high-end kind of Ponzi scheme stuff, mm-hmm. where we're talking about, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I collected all of these statistics and figures and made averages from these, predominantly Jewish authors, Yale University published material, and I came to this final figure of, the cost of Jewish financial crime each year in the United States is between $75 and $100 billion. That's just the financial crime that is detected.
Mm-hmm.
It's between $75 and $100 billion each year. Now, in any sane or healthy democratic system, losing $100 billion a year would be something that is, one, worthy of discussion, two, worthy of action, and three, certainly there should be no restrictions on the discussion of that topic, but it's not even on the table.
And have you published this your findings and your data on this?
So that it's on the Occidental Observer. It's one of my most recent articles. I've published it under the heading of exploring the most recent Philip Green case, actually. in England, but really it's within the overall phenomenon of what I call economic parasitism. And you know, a lot of people might be really shy of that term, you know, parasite or whatever, or be hesitant of using it in relation to Jews because of so much negative, you know, propaganda. We're supposed to be very wary of the words that we use. But when you look up the dictionary definition of the parasite, these economic con artists, these white collar criminals, are essentially parasites. They're living off of a otherwise healthy host, but they're you know, really sucking the lifeblood of it out of the system, and dispersing it in ways that benefit their interests more specifically, but also, as I said before, the interests of their ethnic community. It's to my mind, a very, very serious issue. It cuts to the heart, actually, I believe, of historical friction between Jews and non-Jews.
Mm-hmm.
It is a predominantly economic problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Jewish problem, if we want to call it that, is an economic problem. To the extent that you know, whether it's money lending or money as a means of exercising political, social, or cultural influence, money is what keeps the whole thing going.
Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine that Jewish influence would be what it is without the extravagant wealth that it enjoys.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens that lots of this extravagant wealth is not fairly gained. It's gained by piggybacking on honest work and labor.
Mm-hmm.
From other groups.
It is. I look at the history of 20th century Russia / Soviet Union, and you can look at the Russian Revolution as a massive transfer of wealth. So you had, you know, we know that the Bolsheviks were largely Jewish, not exclusively Jewish, but had certainly a Jewish core. And in fact, Lenin, who was part Jewish, had it turns out he had a pretty strong Jewish identity. And half of the Politburo was typically Jewish in the, you know, the first 15 years or so. And what happened at the beginning, right off, you had a transfer of assets, of wealth, from both the crown and also from the church to a Jewish-dominated state. So from non-Jews to Jewish control. And then a decade later or so, you had this transfer of land wealth from the alleged kulaks, the wealthier peasants, and the peasantry in general, with forced collectivization of agriculture, to the state, in a process that created massive famine and killed millions of people. And so you had the transfer of basically all wealth in the Russian Empire to this state that was controlled initially by Jews. When Jews gradually lost control of the state through the Stalin years and later, then you have the overthrow of the state. And with the overthrow of the state in the 1990s, you have a privatization that benefited almost exclusively Jews at the expense of non-Jews. So you had in the 1990s, you have a situation that starts with a state that is not under, well, I mean, the Soviet Union was not really under Jewish control at the end. It controlled the assets, and then through this process of privatization, the state assets then go to private Jewish hands. So if you look at the 20th century as a whole, you're going from, church and private and, imperial family ownership of assets to, by the end of the century, private Jewish ownership of assets. So you see that transfer of wealth. And, you know, in a somewhat less dramatic way, you see it all through the United States, for instance. Piece by piece, Disney builds up a big company. It gets taken over by Jews. The Washington Post was not a Jewish newspaper, but it wound up having to be sold to Jews at bargain basement prices because of the power of a Jewish advertiser boycott on the Washington Post. And then the what I want to get to is the educational institutions, which are a massive wealth asset. You think of Harvard. I mean, Harvard has a foundation or what do you call the university's trust fund? It's $32 billion, something like that. It's been taken endowment. Thank you. The endowment. It's huge, and these other schools also have huge endowments. But then beyond that, what does that wealth get used for? It gets used for controlling the narrative, for controlling truth. What is what is considered to be true? What is knowledge in the society? And this gets to why I think your work is so valuable, because it's difficult. It's difficult to do the type of research that you do. It takes a great deal of time and energy, and if you don't have financial backing, you can't do it full time. And I'm not sure what you do with most of your. I'm not sure exactly what kind of research you do to make a living, but I have the feeling that there's not a whole lot of money in the type of research that we've been talking about today. And this is how they can control the narrative, is because through their domination of academia and the media, they're just and think tanks and things like that, there just isn't the money available for any researcher to do this kind of research and get paid for it. And in fact, if you do it, you're even if you're doing it on your own dime, you might have another job. If you might be ruined, your other occupation, your other business, your source of income might be ruined by the Jewish revenge that is sought on people who do this type of research. So.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much for the work you do, but getting back to the transfer of assets and transfer of wealth, we see this in our society. What are some good examples of transfers of wealth that you'd like to bring up?
I think even simply, when you look at the Mark Rich case, mm-hmm. it's a classic example of large-scale tax evasion,
and this is somebody who famously was pardoned by President Clinton in his last day of office, and President Clinton in the pardoning cited his philanthropy to Jewish charities.
Exactly. I mean, it reaches almost the point of self-parody, the Mark Rich case. But here you've got a guy who's defrauded the American taxpayer of really hundreds of millions of dollars, probably more. That's just what the FBI was able to nail him for. This is money out of the pocket of the American taxpayer, and it's being pumped into Jewish causes. And somehow, as you've just said, Clinton's explanation or exculpation of this individual is that we're supposed to feel more inclined to give him a pardon because he distributed most of the money he stole from us to Jewish causes. The Jewish campaign to get this guy the pardon was absolutely extraordinary. The ADL, the Greenberg, I think, is the name of the guy who was head of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., all of the luminaries of the international Jewish community in Spain even lobbied the King of Spain to intercede on behalf of Mark Rich. I mean, it really just shows you the extent of international Jewish influence. But it's ridiculous. The most ridiculous part of the whole pardon petition was this allusion to the fact that Rich had given a lot of this money to the Jewish community as a whole. I'm sorry, but that just doesn't wash with me. The public at large need to become more savvy and more alert to the fact that there is an existence a Jewish microeconomy. It is a microeconomy. It is enclosed.
And micro implies it's small, of course.
Sub-economy?
Sub-economy?
Yeah, sub-economy. Small only to the extent that it's smaller in scale, I suppose, compared to the broader international economy. But it's closed. That's what I want to emphasize. Mm-hmm. It's closed. Once money goes into it, it doesn't come back out.
Okay.
Once all that, hundreds of millions of dollars, or you know, we're talking about $75 to $100 billion each year in the United States. Once that money is transferred into the Jewish community, it serves Jewish interests. It will not trickle back out. It will set up other so-called Jewish entrepreneurs in their parasitic businesses. It will fund movie projects that continue to brainwash the public. It will, as you say, go into universities where you go walk into a library and pick out a Jewish authored work of history, and you will see that more often than not it was funded by some kind of grant or small endowment from a university. And where did that money come from? It all can be traced back to this kind of ill-gotten wealth. So, this issue of a microeconomy. I mean, even like institutions like the ADL, hospitals just for Jewish old people or whatever, we have no equivalent, really. We don't. We might have Catholic hospitals and things like this, but they're not as ethnically exclusive as their Jewish counterparts are. There was a case in England, actually, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, where a Jewish school very much resisted the admission of a male child who, I think his father might have been Jewish, but his mother wasn't. And they didn't want to let this kid into the school. The mother and father had been, there had been a divorce. I don't think the child was being raised as Jewish, but she knew that it was a good school and obviously it was well funded. So she wanted to send her son there. But the school rejected him. And there was actually a huge legal case. It went all the way, I think, to the High Court in London as to whether or not this school should admit the child. In the end, the Jewish school was forced to admit the child, but not after expending tens of thousands of pounds in trying to resist letting what they perceived to be a non-Jew come into to their school and use their resources. And you can multiply that many times over, for examples, probably across Europe and across the United States, but they jealously guard their resources once it's in that sub-economy, if we call it that.
Mm-hmm. And I finally, regarding this ethnic networking and regarding the sub-economy, there are a lot of the economy is under the control of Jews. A lot of business are, and even if you look at new businesses, you find so much of the new economy, whether it's Google or Facebook, a lot of them are run by Jews, and they've become very large and massive companies. Now, we in the United States, we have Donald Trump running for president, and he's not Jewish, and he has a fortune of some billions of dollars, and occasionally he is belittled in the Jewish media for having made a statement that he started his business with a small $1 million loan from his father. And to somebody in middle America, there's no such thing as a small $1 million loan. What's amazing is that if you look around, whether it's people like Steven Spielberg in Hollywood, who as a sophomore in a not particularly elite film school in California was given a massive budget to do a episode of a network TV show where he could just take a truck of tractor-trailer truck and run it off a cliff. I mean, he was given, as maybe a 20-year-old, 21-year-old sophomore in college, he was given that type of resource to make a episode for a TV show. You think of these young Jews in the former Soviet Union who wound up becoming the oligarchs. And what were they doing in 1990? They Tymoshenko, who is the former prime minister of Ukraine, who's only part Jewish, but I'm bringing her up as an example. She and her husband were just running a video store. They weren't great industrialists or anything. They're just running a video store, but because of the Jewish connections, they had access to all this Jewish capital. So many of these people at very young ages had access to massive Jewish capital, so they could get, they could then buy up the assets of the assets that were being privatized. Nobody else had any cash, and the ruble had collapsed. Nobody had cash. You see this over and over again. You know, Google was certainly not the first internet search engine. You had Yahoo, which was a couple of Oriental students at Stanford University. I used to use Yahoo before it was even Yahoo.com. And so they have, you know, very young Jews have access to, you know, financial capital. They have access to media. I mean, you can have these very young Jewish people like Ben Shapiro, who looks like he's barely through adolescence, and he's given a major platform. And this is a kind of networking that and a kind of opportunity that very few non-Jews have. So I've been gone on kind of a rant, but what's your response to that?
I really think you've hit the nail on the head. You know, this is it's just a standard feature of the modern economic Jewish profile. It's this closed sub-economy that facilitates the expansion of Jewish control and power and influence over in business life. You mentioned you know, Spielberg and then some other individuals there who benefited at a young age from what I would call communally pooled resources and funds and monies pooled within the Jewish community or gathered through Jewish networking and influence, and then provided to these young guys starting up. Well, an excellent example is Philip Green, or Sir Philip Green. He received a knighthood. I don't think he, in the long term, he might be able to keep it, but he's this British Jewish entrepreneur who, at the age of 12, I think his dad died and he inherited the family business, but more importantly, the whole Jewish community in London gathered around him, and he was able to tap into a large amount of money. He didn't even finish school. You know, a lot of these Jewish entrepreneurs, they don't finish school because they don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
But he left school, I think, at 15 years of age, and he immediately was able to set up in business as a major shoe importer, importing cheap Chinese-made shoes and sneakers from the, you know, in a large scale. That was in the 1970s. Now, in the 1970s, Britain was experiencing a recession, and lots of, you know, stores, chain stores, you know, we're not talking about just your little corner shop here, but quite substantial stores were encountering difficulty. And what Green was able to do with this money that was gathered up within the community was he started buying these businesses that were in trouble. Again, this is a pattern. You know, this kind of predatory approach to the difficulties of others, whether they're defaulting on loans or whether they're just going to go bankrupt. And all of a sudden, you know, these Jewish capitalists kind of swoop in and just take everything. Well, Green just started gobbling up everything on the British high street. And, you know, before long, he'd taken over so many different stores and restocked them with cheap Chinese products as the whole globalization train really got going, that he formed the Arcadia Group, which is just an overarching group to oversee all of these businesses. And he basically came to oversee a clothing empire that all started with him being provided with a large amount of money at a young age by his co-ethnics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eventually Green grew up to be like so many other examples from his particular group, a con man and a thief. I mean, the guy has the business office for the Arcadia Group in I think North Africa, in order to avoid paying tax. I mean, he's evaded paying hundreds of millions of pounds in tax, much like Mark Green, although he's managed to exploit legal loopholes in order to stay just on the right side of the law. But you know, he went to fancy dress parties with Tony Blair, with Bill Clinton. He had Destiny's Child and Rod Stewart come to play at his son's bar mitzvah.
Uh-huh.
He lives this lavish, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio comes to his beach parties, and he just throws money at people, and he gets away with it. And only recently did he finally get some bad press, was because some time ago he purchased this business called British Home Stores, or BHS. And when he bought it, it was in the black. It was a profitable business, and more importantly, it had, I think, about 300 to 400 workers, and in the pension fund of BHS was something like 530 million pounds. So it was doing okay.
You said 300 workers. Do you mean 300,000? How many workers did it have?
No. It was about 300 workers. It didn't have a huge staff,
uh-huh.
But it was a very successful business.
Okay.
But he basically latched onto this business, and he just started dismantling its infrastructure and selling bits and pieces of it off. One of the things that he did was, whereas BHS owned all of the shops, the storefronts that it occupied, Philip Green, once he bought the business, he sold the storefronts to another aspect of the Arcadia Group, and then he charged BHS, the business, rent to, they had to now rent their own storefronts. And this started to drain the financial properties of the business. So that was one of the tactics that he employed. But he also just started selling infrastructure and outsourcing parts of the work to be done, and sort of cheapened the assets overall. But I think one Guardian journalist basically said that he milked it until it was on its knees.
Mm-hmm.
He sucked it dry. He completely sucked it dry. And I don't think the word parasite could ever be applied to a human being more than it can be applied to Philip Green. But he brought this once profitable business completely to its knees, and then he sold it. He sold it to this shady little group that had been constructed out of nowhere that just so happened to be operated by two fellow Jews. And then the business went bankrupt and it completely collapsed. And it was only after the complete collapse that it was discovered that the 530 million pounds of workers' pensions, and it probably was more than 300 workers there, but you know, this 530 million pounds, so we're talking around the region of $800 to $900 million, had vanished. And we know whose pockets that money went into. It went to Philip Green's.
Mm-hmm.
But this man's still walking free. Now, that's one of the things I want to add on to my earlier discussion, was that figure of $75 to $100 billion a year that it costs the United States for Jewish financial crime, that doesn't take into account the kind of activities of Philip Green. It doesn't take into account all of the activities that somehow manage to stay on the right side of the law, even if they are on the wrong side of the moral delineation that we may look at the affair in terms of. So, you know, talk about transfer of wealth. What does Philip Green like to donate to? Well, when he's not funding such lavish bar mitzvahs for his children, he's investing heavily in organizations like Jewish Care. I think he gave them £100,000 recently. I think in total he's given them something like $500,000 already. And we don't know what else he's giving to, but we can be certain that he's propping up the Jewish community financially as part of his business practice. So, you know, the wealth transfer, it's a serious problem. This existence of a sub-economy is a serious problem. I'm not entirely sure how one could strategize against it.
Being able to talk about it is certainly the first step.
Yeah, exactly. Talking about it, and that's why I'm doing the research that I'm doing and publishing what I'm publishing on the Occidental Observer and other outlets, is basically to not only get the discussion going, because to a large extent, people within our movement and the alternative right certainly are discussing these problems, but really I want to, I intend my contribution to be the provision of really hardcore facts, which are very difficult to dispute, and which frame the argument in a way that intelligent and right-minded people are apt to consider.
And it's so valuable. It's so hard to do. Even people with the capability, intellectual capability of doing this kind of research, just often can't, because they're too worn out from making a living just to keep themselves alive. So anybody who's able to do this kind of quality research and get this information out there, I mean, the case for our position is so strong, but making the case is difficult because it takes this kind of work. And I really appreciate what you do, Dr. Joyce, and I hope that you'll be able to come on and talk with us again sometime in the future.
Absolutely, Patrick. It's been a real pleasure.